From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. What is consciousness? Think about it for a minute. It seems simple enough. It's an awareness of ourselves, of our condition in the context of the world. Maybe that's it. I don't know. Susan Blackmore says consciousness is at once the most obvious and the most difficult thing we can investigate. For thousands of years now, philosophers have struggled to define it or explain it. Science ditched the whole concept for a time, but they're back. Psychologists and biologists and neuroscientists are digging in to figure out what consciousness does, whether it's a product of evolution, whether it's even real. Susan Blackmore is joining us today to help us work through all of this. There are a lot of questions. Is consciousness something only humans have? And if so, why do we have it? Join us after the news.
KUER's volunteers give their time year-round to lend a helping hand. Our volunteers staff booths at special events, help with paperwork in our membership department, and assist the news and Radio West teams with behind-the-scenes details. Maybe you're a photographer or a graphic designer and you'd like to volunteer your skills. Or you have some spare time that you'd like to donate. We're always grateful for a little extra help from our friends. Find out more about volunteer opportunities at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are going to talk about consciousness. But what is that? What does that mean? Is it self-awareness? Is it that cognizance that makes us contemplate our condition in the scheme of things or our mortality? And there are a lot of things that we do know about the complicated mechanisms of how creatures work. We're getting a better understanding of how the brain works, of perception, of thinking and feeling. But consciousness is still pretty hard to pin down. It's even hard to define. And here's a big question the psychologist and writer Susan Blackmore has been asking. Is consciousness an extra ingredient that we humans have, or do all creatures have it in some way? Is consciousness just an inseparable part of life? Susan Blackmore is a freelance writer and lecturer and broadcaster. She's the author of numerous papers on consciousness and several books on the subject, including Consciousness, A Very Short Introduction. Also, she wrote Zen and the Art of Consciousness, and she's joining us today from her home in Devon, England. Susan Blackmore, welcome. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. When did you start?
I'm conscious. Well, I want to get to that question. That's a big question that you contemplate.
Indeed.
Of course. When did you start thinking about, seriously, about this subject? Because you've thought about it for a while now.
I have thought about it for a while. Like most things in my professional life and in my personal life too, go back to an extraordinary out-of-the-body experience that I had back in 1970. Yeah. I was kind of already interested. That was the year that I went up to Oxford as a student to study psychology and physiology. And just completely out of the blue, as it were, I had this extraordinary experience. I kind of was interested in psychic things and, you know, weird stuff already. But that experience was a real total flip in my mind, because nothing that happened to me then could be explained in terms of the science I was learning then. And that was the kind of psychology that wouldn't have anything to do with consciousness in those days. It was behaviorism, you know, study the behavior of rats, don't think about the mind and consciousness at all. And I became obsessed with it. And in one way or another, everything I've done since has kind of touched on it, until I got to the point, hang on, the real fundamental question underlying all of the stuff I've done, you know, the parapsychology, the mimetics, all the other weird things that I've done in my life, and the meditation that I've done for 30 years, in a way, they all come down to that fundamental question. Well, what is this experience I'm having?
Can you, we'll dig into this as we go. Have you come up with a neat, tidy definition of consciousness?
No. Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
Right.
Oh, I'd be famous and all. Oh, that'd be great if I had. No, I haven't. Nobody has. The closest that people get really is either to say it means subjectivity or subjective experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the things that are only I can see or hear or whatever. But the better definition, I think, if it is a definition, comes from a very famous paper by Thomas Nagel back in 1974, the philosopher, who wrote a paper which he thought demolished materialism forever, which nobody thinks it did. But along the way, he asked this question, what is it like to be a bat? Now, he chose a bat because a bat is so different from us. You know, they fly around really accurately, not bumping into things, not by vision, but by using sonar, reflected echoes off objects and so on. And of course, they hang upside down to go to sleep. So they're very different from us. We can sort of try to imagine what it's like to be a bat, but that's no good because we're imagining being a bat. Mm-hmm. But if we kind of magically, in a thought experiment, became a bat, well, then we wouldn't have our own human minds and language. And so we wouldn't be able to say what it was like, even if it was like something. So that underlines some of the basic difficulties of the problem of consciousness. But what really came out of that paper and sticks around today is this idea. If there is something it's like for the bat, something it's like to be the bat, that's what we mean by being conscious. And if there's nothing it's like to be the bat, then that's what we mean by not being conscious. So if I ask you, I've got a cup of tea in my hand. If I ask you, is that cup? Is there anything it's like to be that cup? What would you say? Surely you'd say no, wouldn't you?
Well, of course. I mean, in the sense that it's a material object, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're very happy with material objects like cups and stones and desks and other things like that. There's nothing it's like to be them. Now, is there something it's like to be you?
Of course.
Okay, of course. So now, what about all the in-between? What about babies? What about slugs? What about, well, any other person, because you can't really know, can you? Anyway, the point of all this is to say what we mean by consciousness is what it's like to be me now. Yeah. That's my consciousness. And that's what we're trying to understand. And that's the problem.
Right. I hope your
head's hurting already.
Well, it's going to hurt all hour, I think.
It is. Good.
Right?
Good.
And that's a good thing. Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
One of the crucial parts of the conversation that you've been talking about and dealing with is the difference between, whether there is a difference between the physical and the mental world. And you write about in your book that they do seem different. A physical thing has a shape and a heft. A mental thing is a private experience. It's a subjective. It's the feeling of pain.
Yep.
It's the color of an apple or a bird or something like that. And that has sort of brought us to this philosophy of dualism. Descartes, who said, you know, the mind is non-physical, the body is physical. It's substance. Explain how this gets us to part of the problem, this idea of dualism.
Right. Well, Descartes has to be wrong. Descartes was a fantastic thinker. He was really skeptical and he kept asking questions. You know, how can I know this? How can I know that? Mm-hmm. And so I admire him greatly. But when it came to trying to solve the mind-body problem, he couldn't. This is what it's called, the mind-body problem, that as precisely as you said, mental experiences seem to be private, ineffable, you know, so on, whereas the physical world seems to be out there and everyone shares it and it's really there. That's how it seems to us. Now, we know from modern psychology that this kind of impression of dualism starts very early in childhood. Mm-hmm. Children quite early, age 3, 4, start to think about minds as different from bodies. When you ask them, you know, if your hamster dies, what happens? You know, they kind of imagine mind survives and body can die.
Right.
The separation between mind and body seems pretty much intrinsic to the way human beings think. But it can't work. You know, Descartes tried to make it work by saying, well, mind and body connect in the pineal gland. Well, the pineal gland, right inside the very middle of the brain, is just a physical thing. It doesn't help to say that it, you know, how could it connect with mental things? And nobody has ever come up with a solution to the mind-body problem. And that is the essence of the problem of consciousness, because what we're talking about with consciousness it doesn't seem to be physical. Somehow we have to get to non-duality. Now, there are lots of mystics and there's a whole kind of science of non-duality going around now, where people claim to be able to enter non-dual states in which the duality disappears. But for most of us, most of the time, there seems to be me sitting inside my head, looking out through my eyes, having my own private experiences, but those experiences are reflecting a real world out there. And then you come to the real problem about the brain. Well, the brain is a physical object. We can take it apart. We can scan it. We can see what it's doing. We learn more and more and more and more. And, you know, the more we learn about how the brain works, the worse the problem of consciousness seems.
Right.
Because there doesn't seem to be anything left, anywhere for it to be or anything left for it to do.
Yeah. I want to dig into that actually a little bit later in the program. Well, let me get to this question, which is, I think, one that comes up all the time. And it's kind of, you describe it as the central dispute, or one of them anyway, in consciousness studies. And it's this question of whether or not, as I mentioned there in the introduction, consciousness is an extra ingredient that we humans have. Yeah. Or the other option is it just an inseparable, intrinsic part of life, of being a creature? And so that raises the question, do animals have consciousness? Now, how do you talk about that question?
Well, let me start with the first part, because those are really two very big questions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this business about the extra thing, the reason I come to that in my big textbook on consciousness is that when you look into all the academic people writing about consciousness, they tend to split into two groups. It's rather crude grouping, but I find it helpful. Mm. On the one hand, the vast majority seem to treat consciousness as though it's some kind of extra force or power, that it has functions, that it does things, and that we might be without it. So there's the very famous idea of the philosopher zombie, which is the idea that there might be a Sue Blackmore exactly like me, that would behave and look and appear in every possible way exactly like me, but it's all dark inside. In other words, it would be like a very clever robot, and it would be able to say things like, oh, I'm conscious, and isn't it a lovely day today, and so on. But it would only be saying them because it had whizzing round things inside that made it say it. Now, if you believe in the possibility of zombies, that means you believe that consciousness is something extra that we might or might not have. And a lot of people do think that. And then the people on the other side would say, and I'm on the other side, would say, that's ridiculous. It isn't, consciousness isn't some kind of power or force or extra thing that's kind of added on. It's absolutely intrinsic. Any organism or a machine, even, in my opinion, that could process information, take in light, sound, whatever it is, represent the world to itself and represents itself as being in the world, would think, would have the duality problem, would become a dualist, would think it was separate from the world, and would invent the problem of consciousness and so on and so on. But really, it's a kind of illusion. There isn't anything called consciousness, and consciousness doesn't have any powers or force or anything else. Now, that's a pretty far out. I'm at the very, very extreme end of that. I don't think consciousness has any consequences. I don't think it evolved separately for its own reasons. Yeah. I don't think it has any functions. I think it's just an inevitable consequence of being the kind of animal that we are, the kind of machine that we are, that processes information in the way we do.
What do you make of the question that often comes up? Humans, and again, this, it seems like throughout history, we've always tried to distinguish ourselves from other creatures. Mm, we're the only ones that laugh. We're the only ones that have joy. We're the only ones that, have, aside from those basic impulses, pain and fear. Sure, animals have those, but humans are different. And humans are different in this way, in particular. We are the only ones aware of our mortality, that we are going to die, that we consider, the existential nature of ourselves. What do you do with that question?
Well, I think that's true. I think going to the simpler end of things, I completely agree with you that many other creatures have a kind of sentience in the sense that they respond to things, they can find their way around. I mean, look at my cats, they run around the garden, they know when it's tea time, they're pretty clever creatures. They're a lot cleverer than my chickens, which are pretty stupid, but even they, they know when it's feeding time and they look forward. They get really disappointed if you give them a bit of Layers pellets instead of some corn. don't want that.
Right.
They have minds, they have minds in that sense. I would guess, but I can't find out, that there's something it's like to be a chicken, because the chicken is moving around and everything's changing and it's processing all that information. Now, coming on to whether we humans are so special, lots of things have fallen by the wayside. There are a few other creatures that make tools. There are some others that can understand lots of clever things and so on, so on. But I personally think that we are fundamentally different from every other creature. Why? In my opinion, and this is another kind of far out thing not many people agree with, but because we can imitate. And imitation seems so easy to us. But imitation is actually a very complicated and difficult skill for any brain to do. And hardly any other creatures on this planet can imitate at all. Some birds can imitate sounds. Whales and dolphins can imitate a bit. And there is limited, very little capacity for imitation in our closest relatives, the great apes. Mm-hmm. We just find it easy. That means we let loose another whole world of evolution, mimetic evolution, the evolution of memes, you know, ideas, skills, and so on, which we pass from person to person. That gave rise, in my opinion, to language, to culture, and so on. And once you have language, then, as you said, you start to think about your own mortality, because you start being able to talk about things, to talk about the future and the past, to talk about yourself as existing separately from everybody else. And all of that really does make us different from other species.
But that's not...
Now, whether that has any implication for consciousness is difficult to say. It does, in the sense that it has great implication for self-consciousness.
Right.
So if I sit here now and kind of think about myself, I'm sitting here in front of this microphone and speaking to all these people far, far away across the other side of the planet. That's a self-consciousness that I don't think most other creatures can possibly have. But I'm not always being conscious of myself. I'm going around in the world doing things as other animals are. So at that level, I think we're pretty similar to lots of other creatures.
So if consciousness, as you believe, is not this added an ingredient for humans, it's just an intrinsic part of life for a creature, if that's the case, the questions become different. It means there is no secret sauce, you know, no mystery ingredient.
Exactly.
And you say in your book that our task then, if this is the case, is different. And you put it this way. You say the task then is to explain why there seems to be such a problem and why we seem to be having ineffable, non-physical, conscious experiences, which gets us to the big question of, is consciousness then just an illusion, right?
Yes. I don't like the just.
Yeah.
I would say consciousness
right.
is an illusion. It's a really, really interesting illusion. It's, you know, it's the big illusion, you know, along with free will and various other things. Mm-hmm. But I must make it clear what I mean by illusion.
Yes.
I don't mean it necessarily that it doesn't exist. I mean, we've got it wrong. You know, if you see a visual illusion, something that looks like a square, and they go, oh, no, it's not really, you know, that sort of thing. It's not that there's nothing there, it's that you misinterpret it, or you have some strange sound or whatever, and you misinterpret it. So this is what I mean about consciousness. I mean, it's not that there's no problem. I'm sitting here and, you know, I'm looking out the window and, you know, there's a world there. This is how it is to be me. This is what it is to be me. This is a problem. I'm not denying that. But I'm saying that it's actually an illusion that there's this stuff or thing or whatever called consciousness, and all the things we've been talking about, if there is a mind-body problem, we seem to be unable to solve it. I would say there isn't really. The mind-body problem comes about because we're looking at things in the wrong way. Now, I can't tell you what the right way is, so maybe I'm, you know, I'm just doomed. But I think we have to begin by seeing how deluded we are. We're deluded in the sense of believing that zombies are possible. But one of the most popular method of trying to understand consciousness in science at the moment is looking for the neural correlates of consciousness.
Yeah.
In other words, looking for what's happening in the brain when there's consciousness as opposed to when there isn't consciousness. Well, I don't think they will ever find that. So my position is perfectly testable, because if somebody comes up tomorrow with, ha-ha, my brain scanner has found the consciousness bit, then I'm wrong. I don't think they'll ever find it, because I don't think it's like that. That's kind of what I mean by it being an illusion. Somehow we have to undelude ourselves, de-delude ourselves. Mm. And when we do, I think we'll look back and go, oh, goodness me, how muddled they were back in the 21st century.
Well, it seems like you're with Dennett on this, then, the idea that consciousness is, and I think it's been thought of this way, consciousness resides somewhere in the brain. It's over there by this impulse or that impulse. I guess that's a wrong way of thinking about it, then. It's not, the brain is the center place for the consciousness. It seems to be a kind of fundamental misunderstanding about the brain, really. Is that right?
Yes. And you're absolutely right. My ideas are very close to Dan Dennett's, not when it comes to free will and other things, but in terms of consciousness.
Yeah.
So I think what he's saying, and which I agree with, is something like this. What's going on in the brain, and we can see this happening from, you know, 100 years or more of brain science, what's going on in the brain is multiple parallel paths of processing. For example, in the visual system, there's something like 40 parallel pathways in which the information is all, you know, streaming around, color extracted, shape, size, perceptions, you know, all doing, going to different parts of the brain for different purposes, some of it leading to the mouth to make you speak, and some of it controlling your arms and, you know, whatever, all driven by the visual input. And it doesn't all come together in some magical place where consciousness happens and I am aware of the world. The brain isn't like that at all. So in my opinion, what happens is all these parallel streams are going on, and just occasionally we ask ourselves, well, which ones am I conscious of? Mm. And then we pay much more attention to those things and we go, ah, that's what I was conscious of. And it's always a kind of retrospective story that we're telling ourselves. Oh, I was conscious of that, but not that. Now, this is a difficult thing to grasp. It's very close to Dan Dennett's multiple drafts theory. And people misunderstand this again and again. It's so counterintuitive and so extreme by most people's lights that I'll just explain it briefly again. There are lots and lots of parallel things going on in the brain all the time. Yeah. None of them is actually conscious. None of them is actually unconscious. Consciousness is an attribution we make after the fact. So we're sitting here and we think, I'd like some tea. And that's something we're attending to, a lot of processing given to it. Oh, I'm conscious of wanting the tea. Most of the time, we're not doing that at all. Most of the time, we're just getting on with making the tea and drinking it and not bothering to attribute anything of consciousness. If you take this extreme view, there's no kind of extra spark in some bit of the brain where consciousness is. There's only the talky bit that, as it were, that says, I'm conscious of this and I'm not conscious of that. Yeah. And attributes conscious to certain things, not other things in the brain.
Well, there's that question.
Now, that fits very well with everything we know about how the brain works. Because, as I said, the more we know about how the brain works, the more problematic consciousness seems. So, you know, we can see decision-making going on in the prefrontal cortex and vision going on in the occipital lobe and out-of-body experiences being generated at the temporoparietal junction. And, you know, I mean, we there's so much we know about what's going on, and lots of it's going on at once. It doesn't seem to have any room for this kind of special spark thing. So yeah. I think that this is the best way forward.
Here's what you write in your book. In some ways, the brain does not seem to be designed the right way to produce the kind of consciousness that we have. That's what you're getting at there. Most of what goes on in the brain seems to be outside of consciousness. And even
I don't remember writing that. Where did I say that?
You said that in, I can even find it, Consciousness, A Very Short Introduction.
Well, I'm not sure what I meant by that, but I would say that the brain is designed to do a fantastic job of keeping our bodies alive and passing on our genes to make more bodies to stay alive. So I think what I was probably getting at there is it's not designed to produce a kind of special thing called consciousness that's going to control it and make the decisions and so on.
Well, I think that is what you were getting at. So, and I probably sort of put it out of context there. I mean, you were getting at this idea that the brain is a more complicated system than just thinking of the fact that there's one conscious part.
Yes, exactly. You've got it there, exactly. So I think it's the way it's kind of natural for us to be in the world is to kind of think, I'm in here and I'm in charge of this body. It's my body, not somebody else's, it's mine, and I control things. I take in the pictures and see what's going on, and then I decide what to do and I make the decisions. But when we actually look at how the brain is made, it's not made like that. It doesn't have a middle where things come into and where I might sort of sit and make the decisions at all. Everything's just constantly, rapidly flowing from input to output through all the middle bits all over the place. And so it's designed to do its job and to do its job. And the same with my cats and my chickens, to do their jobs. They have to react fast, get food, get mates, do all the things that they need to do, keep warm and all of that. And the brain is really well designed to do that. So why do we end up with this illusion that there's a me in there doing all this clever stuff? Well, maybe that's just a very simple kind of illusion for a brain to create that gets us by. while most of the brain gets on with its major jobs. And the little bit that's going, oh, I'm in charge here, doesn't need to know about the amazing complexity of what's happening.
Susan Blackmore is with us, writer, lecturer, broadcaster. She's also a visiting professor at the University of Plymouth in England. The author of a number of books, among them Zen and the Art of Consciousness, Consciousness, A Very Short Introduction, Conversations in Consciousness. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with writer, lecturer, broadcaster Susan Blackmore. We're talking about consciousness. It's a quandary that scientists and philosophers have been arguing about for a very long time now. I want to come back to, you mentioned that this crazy near-death experience you had some 45 years ago now.
I wasn't near death. It was
Not near death. Yeah, this crazy
Out of the body experience.
Out of the body experience.
Actually, you know, looking back, I had almost all the features that people have in near death experiences, but I wasn't near death.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, that tells you something. You don't have to be near death to have tunnels, lights going into other worlds, and all that stuff. You know.
Well, I wanted to ask you about it because you've come a long way around. I mean, in those days, at first you kind of figured, if I get this right, that your spirit had left your body.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Because that's how it seems. I mean, it is the most powerful, extraordinary experience. You feel as if there's a kind of ghosty-like sort of shape thing that has left the body. You look down, you can see your own body. You know, I think anybody who has this experience, your first reaction is going to be, oh, wow, that's, you know, that proves life after death. That's my soul, my spirit's left my body.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look back and I think that was daft to jump to that conclusion, but I can totally understand, forgive myself for jumping to the, you know, I jumped to a lot of other conclusions that, you know, telepathy and clairvoyance, all those things I believed because of that experience that existed. And then I started to do the research.
Yeah. And I mean, you're obviously incredibly skeptical about all of that, but you don't have a problem with the attempts to explore whether the human spirit or something like that leaves the body. I mean, you don't figure it works like that, but there are people who are trying to sort of figure this out. What do you make of those attempts?
Oh, well, some of them, fantastic. I mean, this is one of the great questions for all of us, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is this life all there is? Am I just this body that is evolved for no good reason at all, just, you know, by natural selection, whatever? And when it dissipates, that's the end of this, what seems to be me in this illusion of self and consciousness. Or is there something that science really hasn't got a hold on at all that could continue into some other life afterwards? Now, there are lots and lots of people have these experiences. In fact, something like 15% of the population claims to have had an out-of-the-body experience at some time in their life. So this is not, you know, only a very few people who come in close to death have at least aspects of that. And these people are convinced. But when you look at the evidence, and I can tell you, I've spent a long, long time trying to investigate all the best claims, and every single one of them falls apart when you, all the ones I did up to the point when I was doing this research, just kind of falls apart. Most people in these experiences, what they see, including myself, what they see is not accurately what's there. And the claims of seeing something at a distance are rare and don't hold up. But one of the experiments going on at the moment, which I thoroughly applaud, is that it's a big study called the AWARE study, based at Southampton University in the south of England, but it's got other hospitals around the world. And they're putting numbers above the beds in cardiac wards where they couldn't possibly be seen by anybody in the room and certainly not by the patient lying underneath it. And they change the numbers regularly and so on. And then they interview the people, and something like 8 or 9% of the people who've had a cardiac arrest in this study claim some kind of near-death experience. And they ask them all whether they saw any of the numbers. And none of them yet have. I don't believe any of them ever will, because I don't think, given all the research I've done and all the understanding that I've now gained from these decades of looking into it, I don't think anything does leave the body. But that's exactly the kind of research that people should be doing, because, you know, if I'm wrong, that will prove me wrong.
Mm. Here's an email from Jim, who writes, where do you think consciousness goes when a person is under anesthesia? When we sleep, we still have consciousness while we dream. But under anesthesia, it seems like we just go blank. Now, you've already talked about whether this is the wrong way of thinking about consciousness, but do you want to respond to that?
That's a perfectly natural way that many people think about consciousness. I used to think about it until I did my head in trying to understand it more. The idea that that's the sort of added extra idea of consciousness, isn't it? That's the, you know, there is this thing called consciousness and it goes away. Mm-hmm. Banged on the head or you have an anesthetic. Another way of looking at it is consciousness, what we call consciousness, is there when there's a kind of mental processing, brain processing, that gives rise to a model of self, a representation of self in the world. Now, when we have an anesthetic, we know from lots of brain scans and so on, that the whole brain very gradually all calms down and there's less and less activity. There simply isn't enough activity to build that kind of representation of the world and the self in it. It's not there. Now, dreaming is very interesting because in dreaming, you go through many different stages. You go down through 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you go up and into REM, rapid eye movement sleep, where most of the dreams occur. The brain is doing very different things in those stages. In dreaming sleep, it's much more active and more capable of building something like a self, but it's cut off from the actual real world. Your muscles are all paralyzed, so you can't act out the dreams. Now, you can have a lucid dream, and that's a dream in which you know that you are dreaming. So that really does involve much more than an ordinary dream when you wake up and go, oh, God, how did I, well, you know, why did I believe that was true? It was only a dream. In a lucid dream, you really feel, oh, I'm in my dream now, and you can even control it. Now, we know that that happens in towards the end of a REM period when there's particularly high arousal, and it looks as though that arousal is in higher in the areas that produce a representation of self. So the question that the man asked there, I think we can now understand in terms of the capability of a brain, whether it's dreaming, sleeping, or under anesthetic or awake, to create a representation of a self that goes around thinking, ooh, this is me and I'm conscious.
Are you with Danet on the question of free will? He had this massive argument with Sam Harris, and probably you maybe now.
Yeah.
Whereas you, I'm guessing, and Harris are thinking that there is no such thing as free will. We are bound inevitably by our biology, by our genetic response, the way we've evolved it. Dennett doesn't agree with that. So you don't actually believe in this idea of free will in that sense.
I think it's a really important question. I think Dennett is slithering away and changing what is meant by free will. When I talk about free will, when Sam Harris talks about free will, we both mean the basic ordinary sense in which ordinary people think of free will. Yeah. That is that I can do something because I want to and for no other reason, not because my brain, you know, determines it or the state of my body causes it or anything, just because I want to. Now, that is not true. I mean, we can look into brains and see what they're doing. We know where a lot of the decision making goes on. It's distributed throughout the brain. So when I am now, I'm sorry, I'm obsessed with tea. I know I'm picking up. I've got a new cup of tea just been brought to me. I'm picking it up now. Now, you could say I did that in my free will. But if you actually look at what a brain's doing, you would see all the activity going on in different bits of the brain. There's probably a thirst center. There is a thirst center that's going, you know, you're talking, you're thirsty. And it's kind of, and then that's connected to the motor business that lifts the arm and lifts the tea, and here I go, lovely drink of tea. So we are, it's like I said about consciousness, we attribute free will to it afterwards. Now, to be clear, I think there's freedom and lack of freedom. I mean, if you're in prison, you don't have as much freedom as if you're not. If you're in a difficult relationship, you don't have as much freedom as if you're, you know, happy and relaxed in your life. There is freedom, and there is will. Some people have a very strong will. If they say they're going to do something, they do it. And other people have a weak will and they go, I'm not going to eat any more chocolate. And then they do eat it. But there isn't the combination. Our will is not free. Strength of will is because of a different kind of brain. And it's not just the biology and the genes. That's a lot of it. But it's all our experience, all the things we know, what language we speak, the ideas we've had, the memes we've come across. All of that is what makes the actions happen. And we just use free will as a kind of shorthand. But I absolutely disagree with Dennett. And I think the problem is that and Sam Harris says this in his argument with Dennett. I think in the end, Dennett thinks that if everybody gave up believing in free will, it would all be a disaster. Well, I don't think it would. And Sam Harris doesn't think it would. And a lot of other people don't. Because you know, I suppose one of the greatest worries, and Dennett, he sat down here in my house at the kitchen table and I thrashed this out with him and, you know, you're wrong. Yeah. And he's come back and he's a good arguer and we've had great arguments about it. But what about the legal system? This is one of the things that worries people. Our current legal system, yours and mine and in Britain, are rather different, but they both depend on the idea of punishment, retribution and so on. Somebody does something bad, then you need to be punished. Yeah. Because they had the free will to not do it and they still did it, so they're bad. That sort of idea. Now, what if and that leads to kind of, well, was this person responsible? Did their genes make them do it? And those kind of arguments which don't get you anywhere. Now, if you'd abolished the whole idea of free will in the legal system, then you'd have to say everything everybody does happens because of the person they are, their genes, their memes, their environment, all of that is why they did it. So instead of asking, were they really responsible for their own free will, you ask, would punishing them, like putting them in prison or fining them or anything, would it do any good either to them or to the wider society? And sometimes you think, well, we do have to lock this person up because we can tell from everything we know that they're going to go out and do a murder again. And we just have to lock them up. And then we can look at this person and think, well, this person really is mentally not capable of coping in this way. They need some help and then they won't do these things again if we can help them. So it would be a much better legal system, I think. And there's another side to this. And this comes into my Zen practice. I've been I'm not a Buddhist, but I've been practicing Zen meditation and mindfulness. I meditated every day for more than 30 years. And that takes away the feeling of free will. I don't get the feeling of free will anymore. I'm quite happy just to go along and think that the things I'm doing are happening because this is happening and everything depends on everything that went before. And interestingly, the few people who really seem to have given up the sense of free will seem to be really okay people, you know. They don't go around doing horrible things and, you know, and stealing and murdering and, you know, they're not. It doesn't make for bad people. Actually, I think it makes for happier, more content and more compassionate people, because if you think I'm only doing what I'm doing because of who I am and that person over there is only doing what they're doing because of who they are and their experiences, it's easier to forgive, I think. So I go full way, let's do away with the idea of free will. And sorry, Dennett, yeah, I disagree with you.
It's I'm guessing you get some people feel threatened by this. I think people, especially people who believe in a god, this idea that consciousness is not so special, not a special ingredient, not only something that humans have, I guess people feel really threatened by that. You must get some fairly intense reaction to that, at least in that sense.
Well, I don't in Britain because, frankly, if you believe in God here, then, you know, you're a bit like, oh, really? You believe in God? I know it's very, very different in your country. Yeah. But the norm here, I mean, we now have more than 50% of people in Britain say they're not religious. Yeah. And even a lot of the people who say they're Christians, actually, they don't really believe very much at all and they don't go to church or anything. So I live in a very different climate from you. Right. My starting assumption when I meet someone is they're probably an atheist, or if not, they don't have an opinion. You know, I don't expect to meet someone who believes in God. And if I do, oh, you believe in God? You know, But if I think more about your country, then yes, when I come to the States, I do get strong reactions. But if you think about the structure of religions, let's take the major religions that we're most familiar with, Christianity, Judaism, Islam. The structure of them is always you've got to believe all this stuff, and you've got to believe that there's a God who's in charge, who is loving, even though he does horrible things to you, you know, but still, basically, he loves you. And there's a heaven you'll go to if you're good, and there's a hell you go to if you're bad. And it goes even further in Islam. If you stop believing in it, you can come and apostate, then you should be killed. And in Christianity, you know, bad things will happen to you and you'll go to hell if you stop believing. So there's this huge pressure of these memes, these ideas, to make you go on believing. It's to my mind, it's all just a fabrication that traps people into believing things that aren't true. But certainly if you believe that, then it's rather difficult to let go of the feeling of a little conscious me inside, or to let go of the feeling that I do everything of my free will, and that I'm going to be punished by God if I do something wrong. Oh dear, I'm sorry, I find it so hard to understand how people can believe all this stuff, and I've just given you an argument why they do. but, you know, I'm struggling here because it's so far from the way I think about anything.
Yeah. Susan Blackmore is with us. Among her books, Consciousness, A Very Short Introduction, Zen and the Art of Consciousness, joining us today from her home in Devon, England. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Susan Blackmore. We're talking about the nature of consciousness today. Now let's take a call from Paul, who's in Park City, Utah. Paul, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate your instrumental approach on your references. And I was wondering if you've ever considered the triunion of spirit, soul, and body, with the instrumental approach being there, the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Holy of Holies, the holy place, and the outer court, the Holy of Holy representing intuition, communion, consciousness, the holy place representing the will, intellect, and emotion, and the outer court representing the blood, the body, and the bones. Have you ever considered that as a model for your communication in discovering what consciousness really is?
No. It might be a viable model in some ways. I mean, I was brought up a Christian, so I kind of have some faint idea of what you're talking about, but is that kind of model going to help us when we're trying to understand the nature of a human body and brain and the behavior and the way it feels to be a human? It's kind of, it can give you metaphors and analogies and so on, but I would rather look into a brain with the instruments we have and find out what's really going on. So for me, I wouldn't think it helps.
Where does evolution fit in all of this? I mean, the questions of evolution are good ones if you assume that it's that added ingredient for humans, maybe. And where do you think about in terms of because I think there's this sense, if you think about consciousness in the way you don't think about consciousness, that it's like bipedalism or color vision or the hair that we have on the tops of our heads. That because you do ask the question, could we have evolved without it? So where does evolution fit in the way you're thinking about consciousness?
It's a very, very difficult question. But I think you've put your finger on it there, really, because it goes back to this question of, is consciousness an added extra, which we talked about right at the beginning of the program. So if the consciousness was a kind of special thing that kind of was exuded from our brains and we've got it and some other things don't have it, then you'd have to ask, well, in evolution, why have we got it? What's its function? Mm-hmm. And many people do ask that, and maybe they'll find the answer. But the alternative way, which I far prefer, is to say, no, because consciousness isn't that kind of thing. What has evolved is all the abilities that human brains have. And they have evolved because of the ecological niche that our ancestors were in and the way we came out of Africa and all the things that we know happened in the past evolution of human beings. And we can ask questions about why the brain's doing what it does. But essentially, we look at the brain and think, because we are a species that imitates and has culture and passes on ideas and all of that, you know, starting with lighting fires and stone tools and ending up with, you know, iPads and computers and phones and things. Because of all that, that's what evolution has done for our brains. And it's because, as I said earlier, it's because we are capable of building a representation of ourselves in the world, and we represent ourselves as kind of separate, as in control of our brains, in control of our bodies. Mm-hmm. That's what evolution has done. And it's inevitably produced these creatures who go around kind of holding, I suppose, a sort of simplistic idea about themselves. If we could know everything that went on in our brains, we'd go mad, you know. Mm-hmm. So it has to be that the representation of self is only connected up with a certain part of what's going on, and this gives rise to the illusion of the self as a separate thing, and that gives rise to the mind-body problem, and so on and so on. So that's the way I think evolution is important, but that's only That's the way I see it, as against the idea that evolution is a separate special thing added that must have a function and we need to find the function. I think we only need to find the function of intelligence and memory and learning and vision and all the things, the clever things that the brain does.
Let me read an email from Chris, who writes, what do you think of comparing the phenomenon of consciousness to an advanced user interface over the same basic operating system as other kinds of animals? Makes the animal much more capable, but also can introduce new problems. Are you following?
Yes,
are you following there?
I'm with that all the way. It may not in the end be quite the right analogy, because the operating systems we know about, you know, are not like the brain. But the general gist of what he's saying there, I absolutely agree with. Indeed, that is a much neater way of saying what I was saying in a much more long-winded way, that our brains have evolved to do all these jobs, and they also have this kind of user interface representation, which gives rise to the idea that there is a user in there. It's only an idea. There isn't actually a thing called the user, the me, but it's a good idea that helps us get on in our lives. So, I think that's a useful way of thinking about it.
It seems to crush a lot of science fiction theories. Like the whole Blade Runner idea, wasn't there an idea that what if one day we could figure out consciousness and make a synthetic version and then make a robot who had artificial intelligence? And that was based in this idea of consciousness. As soon as the robots get consciousness, we're screwed. You know, I mean, isn't that the idea?
Yeah, but we don't expect science fiction to be right, do we? I mean, we expect it to be plausible so that we can enjoy it.
Right.
If a science fiction writer, you know, could get it right, then they'd be the scientist and they'd solve the problem. So, you know, it's not surprising that it doesn't quite work. Mm. Also, it often panders to, you know, most people like to feel, for understandable reasons, that there is a self or a soul or a spirit or something or other, a self in here doing it. And of course, it makes sense to imagine that you could put that into a robot and then da-da, it would be more intelligent. But intelligence isn't like that. Already all around us, I mean, Blade Runner is quite a long time ago now, we're seeing not, I think the artificial intelligence that's really going to change our world is not going to come from individual robots that are terribly clever and conscious like us. I mean, already I would say there are robots that have some kind of consciousness in the sense of sentience. You know, they can see the world, they can act appropriately, they can think about certain things, they can, you know, use speech reasonably. But I think the kind of intelligence that's really coming is distributed intelligence out there in the whole world of what I call tech teams, techno memes, that the world, cyberspace, if you like, the cloud, all the emails, everything out there, all the software, all the programs, Google and everything else, all interconnected. The more it's interconnected, the cleverer the whole thing together becomes. And that's where I think artificial intelligence is going. And I think that's very much how our brains came about, you know, masses and masses of things going on all at once in complicated with trillions of interactions. And so if that's right, then if we ask, well, is there any consciousness in that system? Mm-hmm. Then we'd have to say, well, if we understood human consciousness better and the way we construct the idea of self and the idea that the self is conscious and so on, is any artificial system doing that? And I wrote a paper a long time ago called Consciousness in Meme Machines, in which I argued that any robot would be conscious like us only if it was deluded in the same way we are, you know, it built this false but useful model of self. That helped it get around and so on. And it would go around saying, oh, what a problem consciousness is. So that's the way I think about it. You don't get that in science fiction, though.
Right. Andy in Moab has a question. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the French physicist Jean Charon.
No.
Proposed, he says, Andy from Moab, Utah, says that this particular physicist has proposed that each electron in the body is aware of each other electron, and that what he's getting at is that there's this kind of deep consciousness down to an even atomic level. And you get a lot of theories. You ever hear something like that?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, in a way, it doesn't make sense because there's one sense in which every electron is every other electron. You know, they're mm-hmm. not sort of discrete lump. Depends on which kind of theory of physics that you follow. But in a way, this is one version of what's called panpsychism, that everything is conscious. Now, panpsychism might be a way to escape from the problem of dualism, because if you say everything is conscious, then, well, you know, so are we, and maybe the problem of the mind-body problem goes away. But you get a whole lot of other problems, like, you know, if you have a brick, is the brick conscious? Well, if you kind of break the brick in half, have you suddenly made two consciousnesses? Or is every speck of dust that the brick's made of conscious as well? You know, all sorts of difficult problems like that. I am kind of tempted in certain, as I said, I do a lot of meditation. In certain kinds of meditation states, it feels as though there's no separate me from everything else and that everything is awareness. And it seems to me in that state, there isn't really a problem of duality. But then I kind of come back to how it is now and I go, yeah, but that doesn't help me understand a kind of intellectual way. So I have sympathy with those views, but I haven't come across a view of that kind that really helps us solve the problems where we're banging our heads against at the moment. By the way, talking of banging our heads, I do hope your head is hurting a lot from thinking about this.
A lot. I think everyone is. Do you think this
will...
Well,
I encourage that. That's the sort of pain that I enjoy. And right. I'm not trying to be cruel. I hope other people enjoy struggling with it too.
Will this always be beyond our reach? Will we always be having this debate?
Oh, that's a very good question. There are some people, Pat Churchland, for example, a Californian philosopher, and others who would say, well, no, like people used to think light was such a problem. Well, now we say, hey, we just happily accept that light is electromagnetic waves and it doesn't bother us anymore. Maybe there'll come a time when we go, yeah, well, you know, we talk about consciousness, but actually really it's blah, 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 whatever, and we'll be quite happy about it. Maybe the whole idea of consciousness will go away, like the idea of the life force, you know, the élan vital. Before, before modern biology, evolutionary theory, and the structure of DNA discovered, and before all of that, people were looking for the life force. What makes something alive as opposed to not alive? Well, there isn't a life force. We now understand it's all the processes, the homeostatic feedback mechanisms, everything else that keeps something alive. There's not this stuff. And people say it will be the same with consciousness. We'll just kind of accept, well, there isn't a problem anymore. I can't see that at the moment. I think that's the way it might go, but I don't know. And that's what makes it so exciting, really.
Yeah. Well, my head hurts, but that was fun. Thanks, Susan Blackmore. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too.
Great. Joined us from her home in Devon, England. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.